Welcome to today's Innovative Ideas podcast. Our guest today is the economist Tomas Philipson. Tom is the chairman of the Manhattan Institute's Project FDA, professor at the Harris School for Public Policy at the University of Chicago. He is also a former senior economic advisor to the head of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration from 2003 to 2004, and former senior economic advisor to the head of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services from 2004 to 2005. Our subject this afternoon is a new Manhattan Institute paper authored by Tom and Dr. Eric Sun entitled Blue Pill or Red Pill, The Limits of Comparative Effectiveness Research. Tom, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Tom, before we begin, I'd just like to put the topic in a little bit of a context for our listeners. And according to an Institute of Medicine report from just a few years ago, less than half of U.S. medical care delivered, according to the IOM, was delivered to patients based on evidence of, you know, quote unquote, what works. And then, of course, researchers at Dartmouth University have gained quite a bit of attention for themselves by documenting significant variation in Medicare spending across regions and even within U.S. cities, even among what are considered some of the best hospitals in the country. So we've got this perception of the U.S. healthcare, at least for the Medicare program, that there's significant variation in spending. We may not be spending that money very effectively, which led former Office of Management and Budget Director Peter Orszag to quip, and I quote, Medicare spending could be reduced by up to 30% annually without reducing the quality of care. And the administration went on to propose increased spending on comparative effectiveness research as a means to achieve those savings. So we've got this picture of lots of spending variation, potentially wasteful spending, potentially as much as 30% of Medicare spending could be, you know, according to Peter Orszag, reduced without reducing the quality of care. Getting to that point is going to require better knowledge of what works, what doesn't work. And this is the jumping off point for your paper, which takes a reference to President Obama, who said, if there's a blue pill and a red pill, and the blue pill is going to be half the price of the red pill and works just as well, why not pay half the price for the thing that makes you well? So that's where we're at today. What are some of your concerns about comparative effectiveness research, at least the way it's being discussed in the popular media and perhaps among some policymakers, about how it could be conducted and how it might affect coverage decisions for drugs and other medical products?
Well, I think it's important to, if you take a broader view, to think about the role of the public versus private sector in controlling costs. Any industry, including healthcare, profit-making institutions, are very, very interested in controlling costs if it doesn't reduce quality of the products or services they're offering, in this case, healthcare. So in regards to the remark that we could reduce spending by a third without sacrificing quality, I think first of all, no one knows how to do it. And if that was feasible, and then most likely private sector companies would offer, you know, ample compensation to the academics who claim they can do this, if they can save them a third of their spending without sacrificing patient health. Those companies are obviously not offering multiple billion-dollar contracts to academics to come and lowering their costs by a third. That's an indication that maybe this knowledge is more fragile than people think. So the bottom line is no one knows how to do it. So say that it's wasted, I think, is misleading, because that's intending to basically indicate that we know what to do otherwise, and that's not the case. Now, in particular, I think it's important for CER, comparative effectiveness research, to again distinguish what can be done in the public sector versus the private sectors. The CER initiatives that's come through the healthcare reform, both in terms of funding of CER and a little bit of above $1 billion,
the stimulus bill,
that actually, and then also through the PCORI Institute, the Patient-Centered Outcome Research Institute, is a public sector response to generate more information about quality, about the products in this industry. And that has to be, I think, very clearly differentiated from what the private sector is trying to do to, again, generate quality information about their products. And I'll talk a little bit about what's unique about healthcare in that respect. But it is important for in talking about CER is that it essentially is a publicly financed program to generate quality information about medical products. And there will be market responses, we argue in this paper and as done in other work as well, to that infusion of information in the marketplace, which many times doctors and lawyers who are implementing these programs do not necessarily think about. So if you have CER studies, we have argued that they will essentially determine what you can think of as winners and losers of these studies. That is to say, you have products that are there or treatments that are declared better than others. But that will generally, that information, that quality information about effectiveness in the marketplace, we have argued will have two types of responses which may negate the intended effects of these programs. One is just by doctors and patients responding to substituting towards higher quality treatments may have unintended spending effects. That spending might actually go up. That might be a good thing overall, but in terms of caring about the public budget, it might be unforeseen that spending might actually increase when people substitute towards the better treatment. Certainly the winners of these studies are going to have increased sales, and the losers of these studies are going to have decreased sales. So the sort of ambiguous what the overall spending effect is.
For instance, if you were to look at, you know, patient compliance, you might find out that for one type of treatment, there wasn't good compliance, and you could shift to another treatment that looked like it had better compliance. But if you have more people on the treatment, that could result in increased healthcare spending. That may be a great thing if you had better compliance and better health outcomes, but it's not necessarily going to save you any money.
Yeah, exactly. So the question is, what are the budget effects? And increased spending is not necessarily a bad thing if you get more benefits than it costs you to spend. But in terms of looking at the budget impacts, I don't think people understand that if you infuse quality information into the market, it's not at all clear that, you know, the reduced spending on the losers is going to offset the increased spending on the winners. Whether that spending is through more compliance or initiation could be both on the winning side. The second aspect of that we argue is going to be a predictable market response, and you see that already through similar studies in the past, one of which we study in this report, is that payers are obviously going to respond to this information being generated. Naturally, the legislation does not allow for Medicare to basically respond in reimbursement policy, but I think it would be extremely naive to assume that the marketplace would not respond, and we see evidence of that already, that if certain products are declared to work better than other products, that coverage becomes more restrictive for the losers of these studies and more generous for winners of these studies. And that will have some severe unintended effects, we argue in this paper, when CR, which in its current level of debate is basically a product-specific or treatment-specific policies. One treatment is better or worse than another, as opposed to responses to these treatments, which may differ very across patient groups, even if you do subpopulations within those subpopulations, there might be great heterogeneity in how people respond to these treatments. So there's winners and losers out there, regardless of what these studies say. It's just a matter of for whom it's a winner and loser, and that needs to be much better understood before one understands fully the effect of how payers respond to this evidence.
And in particular, you note that there are two problems that can crop up, and the paper focuses on drug reimbursement, and for a lot of different reasons, I think drug reimbursement or the potential savings from drug reimbursement through CER has been a big topic in the media and in policymakers' discussions. You talk about two potential problems, or at least potential issues that CER has to address, and one of them is difference, and the other is dependence. Could you talk a little bit about what you mean by those issues and how they play out in the real-world treatment?
Yeah, so I mean, The big point is that for many drug classes, I would say this is the norm rather than the exception. Different patients respond differently to different drugs, and what's a winner for one patient might be a loser for another. So if you have product-specific studies that try to find the best product, quote-unquote, that's going to be misleading no matter which product is declared the winner. So we looked at, for example, schizophrenia coverage between what's called first and second generation drugs, meaning the drugs that came out initially and now are now generic, and the ones that followed on with less side effects that are now brand name drugs. And we looked at those differences and how people responded differentially to those. And that drug class is typical, I think, of what most drug classes look like, which is essentially of enormous heterogeneity. Even if you control for subgroups such as demographic and things like that, that's not the big part of the heterogeneity. Heterogeneity is within subpopulations, so it becomes essentially bureaucratically impossible to define a program there where you have subgroup-based policies of how much things are going to be reimbursed. said, because it's driven by so many things that we can't look at.
It's at the genetic level or the environmental level. It's so fine-grained, you just can't have the...
I mean, the way this has gone, in a decentralized way of learning, as opposed to CR is a centralized way of learning. The government funds studies, and then it's sort of a top-down way of learning, as opposed to in a decentralized private setting, you have learning on the doctor-patient level, mainly learning by trial and error. And in particular for mental health, the case we looked at, there's a lot of trial and error, and not even severe mental health such as schizophrenia, but just depression. You can go on one treatment and see if it works. Sometimes it has either BMI or sometimes sexual side effects that people don't find desirable or that other people don't care about so much. So you find whatever works for that particular patient by trial and error over time, as opposed to a sort of a top-down declaration what essentially average patients does a given treatment respond best. And I think that's the big difference between a centralized version of generating evidence versus a decentralized version where doctors and patients are trying things to work out what works best for that patient.
And in the real world, this might be thing like vaccines, where the immune response based on people you give the vaccine is pretty uniform, and you just find the vaccine that has the best response in the population. That's the one you go for. There's very little variation. But for others, in this case, you talk about drugs for schizophrenia. Some of them have a significant weight gain, which might have implications for getting diabetes or heart disease. Others have fewer side effects, and therefore people will stay on them longer, keep their disease more controlled. That kind of heterogeneity is just we need to try and learn from experience, and that's at the patient level.
Yeah, and also people care differentially about the side effects. So, I mean, it might be the same drug. The drug has the equivalent response in two patients, but the patients value or weight the side effect differentially across the population.
Their tolerance for side effects varies widely.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, it's not tolerance. It might not be so important to them as actually dealing with them. With the main indication. So even if you don't have differential responses, you might have differential evaluation of the side effect profile that makes people want to be on the treatment or not.
Right. And so we've got a picture here of this class, and you and Eric look at this, and you see that actually from a more restrictive policy that would have restricted access to the second generation, the newer generation of these antipsychotic drugs, you could have potentially larger health care losses than gains. I think the net gain to the Medicaid program was $1.2 billion from sharply restricted access, all but the older drugs, and $1.3 billion in approximate health losses. So, and that's losses due to lost productivity, worse health, those kinds of issues that get played out when you have reduced access to therapies.
Well, basically, there's a standardized way of measuring health effects in the health economics community in terms of quality of life years that are lost, and people trying to convert any kind of health outcome measurements into those units so we can do comparisons across indications and studies. The study we did was essentially taking the CATIE trial as a prototypical example of what would happen when one of these CER studies come out that are currently being funded, because essentially CATIE was a CER study, and we can look at essentially how people responded. And payers did respond by restricting coverage for the losers of the atypicals or second-generation, more modern drugs that were found equivalent to the first-generation drugs in effectiveness in the CATIE trial. They did actually respond exactly as we predicted. They limit coverage for second-generation drugs.
Prior authorization and things like that.
Exactly. So you basically have to have staggered use of first-generation drugs first, and that's a little bit problematic in this drug class because this is a very fragile population, so you might not have them in the office that often. So if they come in once, you're lucky. If they come in twice, that's rare. So if you get the wrong treatment the first time, they might not show up the second time. With the schizophrenic Medicaid population, is not a very adherent population, put it that way. We basically used the CATIE trial as saying, look, here's an example of a CER study that we might see in the future. It declared a winner relative to before, that is to say, first-generation drugs looked a lot better than they did before the trial, and then essentially trace out what will happen to this population on the various coverage policies, some of which were observed and some which were more drastic than observed. The reason we did the more drastic ones is because that's how the discussion was. Many people in the policy area would basically claim that we should not cover less cost-effective drugs without understanding that in this population, that would basically have people go without treatment for atypical or second-generation drugs, which would be severely debilitating for this population. So that's a, that seems to be a statement which most people in favor of CER would agree with without understanding exactly how it would apply. And then we basically traced out if you actually adhere to such a policy that you only cover the more cost-effective drugs, in this case, typical or first-generation antipsychotics, here are the severe consequences of that for patients in terms of health. And then we dollarize that and compare that to the spending differences to show essentially that there's a severe trade-off here where the patient health suffered from this such restrictions many times are larger than the gains in spending.
Right. And also, you know, there's a lot of learning that can go on here. You use another phrase, dependence, in the paper, where I think you talk about, you know, what you learn as the process of you, as you go. So in effect, when patients are given a certain course of treatment, what works, what doesn't work, once you have that knowledge in hand, you can apply it to future patients outside of the clinical trial and say, based on the type of patient we see here, this is the potential course of action that you can take in terms of what you should try first. And then if that fails, here's what you should try second, because that seems to be, you know, support for prescribing. In other words, we can gain lots of knowledge that can improve how patients are actually treated in the real world.
Yeah. So basically there's two types of issues that are individual specific that makes product specific conclusions, such as those coming out of CR studies, troublesome. One is just a difference in treatment effects across patients, and we've argued that even if you do it by subgroup, that doesn't solve many of the problems that people think are solved by doing it by subgroup. Another one is just that this different patients value the same responses differently, so you have different valuations of the side effect profiles across patients, even if the responses are the same of the drug. The third is essentially that you have you're throwing away, by doing these kind of gold standard studies of randomized clinical trials, you're throwing away a lot of information, or you're not getting at a lot of the important information, which is essentially what we call dependence, which is how much does the failure of being on first line therapy tell you about how well you're going to succeed in the future? And that's basically how much do you learn from a non-response of a particular drug you're starting on, whether you're not going to respond to it in the future. So, for example, a frailty of this you see in oncology a lot, if just the frailty of the patients means that they're not going to respond to anything, then essentially once you fail the first, you know they're going to fail the subsequent treatments. That's perfect dependence, if you want. If you have perfect independence, then you don't learn anything about the second-line therapy, how well that's going to work from how well you did. The fact that you didn't respond, presumably, because that's why you're on the second line, on first line therapy. But that dependence, I think, is very important for learning on cost-effective care, and that's many times not obtained in randomized clinical trials, where we sort of get one shot at first start, and then we don't learn anything else. The important point is that when you have decentralized trial and error on the patient-doctor level, you essentially have what biostatisticians would want to call a patient-controlled crossover trial, in fancy language, just saying that you're controlling for other things, so you just have a patient of sample size N, but you actually have the same patient getting different treatments when you do these trials and errors. And that might many times dominate any kind of centralized evidence gathering. It depends on the type of drug class you're talking about. But I don't think that's on the table enough, that the sophistication by which doctors and patients figure out what works for the patient is many times superior to sort of centralized, publicly financed, product-specific studies.
Especially because, you know, for a lot of very good appropriate reasons, trials that are required for FDA approval can be very sterile. You have to have one patient with one ailment. They're not on multiple other medications. You need to get a clear signal for FDA approval, but that may not be what it looks like in the real world, where patients may have multiple illnesses, be fragile, as you spoke about before, have, you know, be dealing with lots of different side effects. So in effect, you can mine lots of real-world information that can improve patient compliance and treatment that might not necessarily come from that original FDA clinical trial.
Correct. Yeah.
And just, you know, finally, in closing, we talk a lot about drugs. The study here obviously focuses on drugs, particularly for schizophrenia, these antipsychotics. but also drugs represent a relatively small part of U.S. healthcare spending. And you and I have talked about before that a lot of information is actually produced by the market in the normal course of companies developing drugs for approval to the FDA and then for payers who want to know, you know, for instance, how does this drug compare to another drug that's out on the market that may be the standard of care? In fact, for clinical trials, it may be unethical not to provide the standard of care, which automatically, in effect, I think, you know, tell me if I'm wrong, sets up a basically a CER trial that you can then use later on in the market to help improve compliance and treatment.
Yeah, I think there's, again, I come back to this important distinction, which I don't think the policy community thinks about clearly, which is the difference between publicly financed evidence gathering, which is the CER movement, and privately financed. So there's essentially two things. And so, like you said, drugs are only about 11-12% of total medical spending. They get a lot more attention in the press, I think, because it's been estimated they're about 40% of the co-pays of individuals. So they're people, when they actually pay for out-of-pocket things, are paying for drugs a lot more because a lot of things are covered by insurance and they don't really see. It's not as transparent what they're paying beyond their premium. They obviously see their premium, but they're not as transparent on what particular services cost that are covered by their either public or private payer. But there's two important issues here that I think comes into the public versus private financing of generating this evidence. One is that there's IP on medical products, whether those are drugs, biologics, or devices, which basically there's owners of those products. What that means is that those owners are going to be the first to generate evidence if the market misperceives their product of having a too low a benefit. Obviously, manufacturers have an incentive to overstate the benefits of their products, like in any other industry. That's true. It's true in healthcare as well. But there's competitors as well who are the first to point out the disadvantages with a given product of their competitors. So there's a competitive marketplace for generating information about these products, and negative campaigns, not negative campaigns necessarily as in politics, but there's certainly a competition enough to generate indicating poor quality of competitors. That's because they have IP, intellectual property, on these products. That's not true, let's say, for procedures which are not patentable. And procedures in the Dartmouth Atlas, you know, constitute a lot of the variation, let's say, in healthcare spending across regions, which may or may not be inefficient. But if it is, it's a much bigger sort of issue where public funding of quality or public funding of better procedures would be much more valuable relative to the private market having the incentives to get the quality information out when there's ownership of these products. The second issue is that the government already mandates effectiveness evidence before you market your product in the medical products case, such as devices, drugs, and biologics, through the FDA approval process, obviously. So that's, again, we have a public mandate on providing quality information for these products already, which is not true for other parts of the healthcare system, such as procedures or just, you know, preventive care or dietary recommendations. For example, diabetes can be solved a lot by limiting calorie consumption, but that's, we don't have any mandated studies on how well that works, etc., which we do have for the medical products. Both these things, the intellectual property and the mandated quality evidence of these products, seems to indicate that public financing may be more usefully employed outside of the medical product space, even though that's clearly where it's getting most play right now.
So in effect, I think what you're telling us, if I can, you know, sum it up a little bit, is we're looking at pieces of the system now, looking at this drug or this device, but really it's been told to me that the most expensive part of the healthcare system is the physician's pen, so that how we go about prescribing things or ordering things, or, you know, to your point, how we structure public programs like Medicare or Medicaid and how they pay for things can have more of an impact on actual healthcare spending or whether spending is appropriate or inappropriate than on a producer who brings a new product to market because they already have to offer information on that product quality. How that product is used or what format it's used in terms of the organization is a whole different question that we're not perhaps looking as closely at as we should.
Yeah, and I think the whole pay-for-performance and quality measurement movement is sort of a signal of that, but it's obviously lagging behind enormously what we're doing on the medical product side. I think if you were to allocate public dollars, I think they would best complement the activities in the private sector if they were going after big ticket items where there's no ownership and when there's no mandated quality information being provided, and that's outside the medical product space.
That's terrific. And the study is Blue Pill or Red Pill, The Limits of Comparative Effectiveness Research. Tom, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.